my gosh, I'm Lisa and I'm an alcoholic. And I was so fine until this all started, and now I'm just crying, of course. And it's just been just a really beautiful, beautiful weekend. And I want to thank everybody that has put this on. You know, I know how much work and effort goes into a convention like this, and the committee, and Jermaine, who's just been incredible. You know, I can just hear Jermaine start laughing, and I start laughing, and she's just taken such good care of me this whole time, and all of you, all of the speakers have just been incredible, and I want to thank Susan, you know, who's one of my dearest friends, and there was a group of us. I got sober in that Alano Club in Santa Barbara that Paul mentioned and Susan mentioned, and now I live in Southern California, and just like these rooms and what people have been talking about in here, you know, there's this rippling effect. Like we come into these rooms all over the world, and there's a magic happens and a beauty that happens and something far greater than ourselves that that emanates through this room, and it's great love and great power. And who knew, you know, you get to experience this by being a hopeless alcoholic and in the, you know, despair and misery and, you know, and I know we need to go through that, you know, to have great suffering to come in here and say, yeah, I'm willing to go to any lengths and I'm willing to take actions that I don't believe in and willing to pick people up from the airport and to be in a room like this on a Sunday morning. So thank you to absolutely everybody. And for those who are new or newer, you know, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope you find what I've found. And that's the most beautiful way to live my life and to stay sober. And I am one of those hopeless alcoholics. And I didn't want to be an alcoholic, you know, as if anybody wanted to. But, you know, I love drinking. I love the effects produced by alcohol. And then at the same time, it's like what it says in the big book, you know, then it becomes like this boomerang, you know, where all of a sudden it's these, you know, horrible things that are happening. And I struggled with this. I struggled to identify as an alcoholic and I've tried everything to not be alcoholic. I tried, you know, drinking when I was younger. I tried drinking after long-term sobriety, which I'll get to in my story. And I thought long-term sobriety had cured me of alcoholism. And it's funny, that doesn't happen. You know, I tried drinking when, you know, I was in more in despair and when everything's going well. And, you know, I am alcoholic. And in my life, you know, that alcohol hit the ism and that ism hit the alcohol. And that's it. You know, it's, and we don't come back from that in the best of all ways. And to tell you just a little bit about my story, you know, like so many of us, but I felt so different, you know, obviously. And when I was a little girl, and it was so weird because I've thought about this over the years, and I viscerally remember it. And I was about 4 or 5 years old, and I was in my bathroom, and looking in the mirror, and I was looking looking straight in my eyes. And my mom came in, and she's like, "What are you doing?" And I said to her, I go, "Where did I come from?" Because I remember like this, I've been some, what is this, you know, as this little 4 or 5 year old. And she said, "What do you mean?" I go, "Where did I come? Where was I before I got here?" And then I said, "And then where am I going after?" So she started talking to me and started to say, like, where babies came from, you know, and you know, like, birthing process. And I go, "No, that's not it." Like, I knew, like, she didn't know. And then she knew. It's funny, when my mom passed away just a few months ago, and she said, you know, she would just look at me and think, "Oh, this kid knows, she knows no things I don't know." And so she'd just kind of defer to me, you know, if I was like, "That's not it." She's like, "Okay, that's not it. Then we'll figure this out later." And so I just was like this weird thing being here in this world. And I was born, I'm the youngest of four kids, with same mom and dad. And But when I was born, my oldest brother was 19, and my sister was 16, and my other brother was 15. So I was this little, like, midlife accident to my parents. And, you know, so my family was a lot, my brothers and sisters were a lot older than me, and my parents, you know, weren't that much older. They were very young when they had my siblings. And so I just didn't kind of feel a part of that family. But my siblings and I also had a very different upbringing, you know. So I came into this family, and it was like this big family, and everybody is like loud and opinionated and dominating. And just to tell you a little bit about my family, to have a little bit of perspective, my oldest brother, because there's always a lot going on, and my oldest brother was in Vietnam when I was born, and he was a Force Recon Marine, and he volunteered to go to Vietnam. He wasn't drafted. And a number of years ago, I asked him, because he volunteered to go, he was shot, and he came home, and then he went back to Vietnam. And I asked him, I said, you know, I can almost understand why you went the first time. And I said, but why did you volunteer to go back? And he said, well, I had a choice between Vietnam and mom and dad, and I chose Vietnam. And said it with all, I was like, whoa. And his relationship with them and my other siblings too, it was, wow, I can really see that, you know? And there was just, oh, it's like this great love and then great volatility. But for me, growing up and being the youngest, you know, I was certainly had the most love of any of them. But I was laughing when Matt shared last night, because you know, I'm a Gen Xer, you know, and we grew up in the 80s, and I saw this meme recently, you know, and it was like, yeah, we were pretty much raised feral, you know, like just you're just off on your own. And I just laughed when Matt's mom was like, hey, can you find another place to live for a little while? You know, it's like there's a whole generation of us that were like raised like that, you know, and we'd go out in the morning and we'd be gone all night. Like, my parents, I remember I grew up in a place called it's in Santa Barbara County in California, in a place called Santa Ynez. And it's all vineyards, it's wine country, and ranches and wine country, and so we would run around on those like Firestone vineyard, or like all these vineyards, and we would just tap the barrels. We had whatever alcohol we wanted, and it was like that's the sport. That's just what people do in wine country. They drink, and so I grew out in the country, and when we were really little, we were just supposed to come in when they rang the bell. You could hear it across the countryside, and it's like nighttime, you know, and we've been gone all day as little kids. And you know, the big entertainment was like, you know, being put in the back of a truck, and my brother would like hit these hills. So all the kids, we would literally pop up out of the back of the truck going like 80 miles per hour, you know, and that was the fun. So it's just different than how it is today, you know, where kids are like coddled and it's just, wow, that's weird, you know. But needless to say, I needed a drink, and I needed a drink at a really, really young age. And I think I did always have that ism. The first time I did anything, I was 11 years old, and my brothers, you know, they drank and smoked pot, did all the stuff. But I was 11, and I was with them, I drank a little and smoked some pot. And we lived out in the country, like I said, and they needed like some candy or whatever from the store, and they gave me the car. So I drove to town. I'm like 11, driving to town and getting us candy. So the first time I did that, I didn't really think much about it. I just felt very grown up, you know, like that was great. And I had tried alcohol before that. And, you know, in our house, we always had sangria in the refrigerator. And I really, I'm not kidding, I think I was like 14 before I realized sangria wasn't juice. You know, to me, it was just like this juice that was in the fridge. But I remember getting to about 12 years old, very old, and when I really started to drink. And, you know, it's really like what, if any of you have heard Clancy, you know, it's like that kaboom. And I remember alcohol hitting my system and thinking, I want to do this always. And I didn't, my friends weren't drinking like that at that age. And But I had a lot of alcoholism in my family, and I didn't know that. My family, my parents hardly drank. They had alcohol for other people. My dad did not drink. And I learned later, once I got sober, it was because of all the alcoholism in my family. And I didn't know that. I kind of thought everybody was perfect. That's kind of what I was told. And lo and behold, it was because of all the alcoholism. So I really believe I was born alcoholic, you know, physically and mentally different when it came to alcohol. So I would, you know, stash alcohol in the bushes going down to the bus stop. And starting about 15... when I was 15, my mom and I got in a really serious car accident, and my dad was, so we lived out in the country in San Ynez, and my dad was an executive at an aerospace company, and so his office was actually up here in Seattle, so he would be in Seattle, he'd be in Los Angeles, and he'd come home on the weekends and most of my life, my mom and I got in this car accident, and my mom almost died in that accident, and she wanted to spend more time with my dad, and so they kind of sat me down, and they said I had some choices, and did I want to move to Seattle, so I could move to Seattle, or I could move to Los Angeles, or I could stay at our home in San Ynez. And so at 15, I thought, I'm staying here. Like, no one was there. And so they left me the car, and I was only supposed to drive to school and back to the San Ynez High School. And so I was like, okay. And so I'm in, so they left. Everybody was gone. And they would come home. My parents would come home. What was interesting, because they came home, and I was told they came home like every other weekend. But after that accident, my mom, she was in a walker for like 6 months, because I remember them talking about it. And I thought, I never saw her in that walker. So the first time they left, they had to have been gone at least 6 months when they came back. So my whole family would come home. Brothers, they were all getting married, and sister married by that point, and they start having kids, and this big family would come home. Everybody would fight, scream, and yell, and then everybody would leave. And a few years ago, someone asked me, and I firmly believe this, someone said, you know, do you have like abandonment issues, you know? And I said, absolutely not at all. Like, I have a lot of issues, but abandonment's not it, because it was like I wanted them gone. And so as a kid, you know, it wasn't like I felt left. And in fact, the other thing is, I always dreamt like I had some great magical family out there too. Like, they were beautiful and loving and, you know, maybe royal or something, but they were just these extraordinary people. So the first time I got sober, I was 19, but my sponsor and I were going to Mexico, and I needed to get my birth certificate. And it was at the Santa Barbara courthouse. And so I remember thinking, I'm going to find out who my real family is, because I didn't even really I looked like my dad, but I didn't really look like them. And so I went down to the courthouse and I got my birth certificate, and I just burst into tears in the courthouse, because I thought, there's my mom and dad's name, like right on that thing. And this lady was there, and she started comforting me, because she thought I just found out I was adopted or something. And I said, no, like, they're my parents. Like, this is my family. And, you know, and it was such a delusion too, because I had also been born on Christmas morning. I was supposed to be born in February, and I was born 5:05 a.m. Christmas morning. So I was like 3 pounds when I was born a long time ago I was healthy. It was really weird. So there was newspaper articles about the first Christmas baby born in the San Ynez Valley. But I was thinking maybe they made that up for the story, and then for my real family that was still going to come in despite the newspaper articles and the story about it. But they were it. That was my family. I was just an alcoholic from the get-go. And then at this very same time, in fact, the first time it happened, I was about 15, and I had this absolute mystical experience where I felt the presence of something far greater than me. And in that moment when that happened, I thought, God is real. Like, this is a real thing. It's not a made-up thing. And so I always had this connection to something higher. And And even when I was little, and my parents don't know where I got this, but when we kind of went to Catholic church, they were Catholic, we kind of go to church, and I kind of, but before I even knew who or what God is or was, or as if I do, but when I was really little too, we found this writing. I could barely write, and it had asked for me to list my friends. And I was so little, I misspelled everything, but I said God, Beth, and Monica were my friend. I spelled Monica wrong, Beth wrong, you know, but God was my friend. And so I always had this thing going on. And so when, you know, 15, 16, you know, I was also one of those people, I would like do cocaine and read the Bible, you know, so I'd get like super high and read the Bible and, you know, and I was always thinking that, I just couldn't not drink. You know, I couldn't not do what I was doing, and I didn't know what was wrong with me, and I'd also started to get really, really depressed, and then in my family too, you're supposed to go to school, like you're supposed to go to school and college, and you know, do these things, and I could barely get to school. I would get to school sometimes, and it was in the days where if you were absent, they'd write a number on a piece of paper, and kids would snap it on the outside of the classroom. So we would just go get your friend to grab that thing, you know. And so, you know, I was hardly ever in school, but I did okay in school. But I too didn't graduate. You know, it was 3 weeks before my high school graduation, and like they say, we're great starters and poor finishers, you know. It's like 3 weeks to graduate, and I was trying to not drink, and it was like 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'd also been told if you miss any more school, you can't miss any more school. So I thought the principal meant that, and so I went to this party, and I just disappeared for like 3.5-4 weeks. Like I just never—I didn't come back. And then I remember watching my high school graduation. Like I, you know, sat up on the hill and drinking and watching them graduate. It was all very dramatic, and I just felt as though, you know, I think I felt as though I was a loser, but then I was also obsessed with, like, you know, Jack Kerouac and, you know, like, all this other stuff. So I thought it was like, you know, maybe I was beyond that, beyond school. But I wanted to go to school. You know, I didn't want to be a mess in my life, and so I went, I wanted to go to the University of Hawaii. Well, long story short, I took the GED, like, 2 weeks after my graduation. So just took that test, passed, I'm fine. And then I wanted to go to the University of Hawaii. My dad said, you're not going to Hawaii in your state. You know, it's so I went to Santa Barbara and pretended like I went to school. And so they would send me checks to go to school, and I wasn't in school. And every once in a while, I'd try, like, and in Santa Barbara, it's beautiful and warm, and I'd try to go to school. And so, like, one time, it was, like, this beautiful day, and it was time for class, and I couldn't find a parking spot. So I'm driving around, can't find a parking spot. And I'm like, I'm out of here, I quit. So I would just like went to the beach. And so I too spent a lot of time down on that beach, you know, where people are playing volleyball and, you know, I'm taking the checks and all this kind of stuff. But something started to happen. And I, in those days too, they handed out Melaril and Thorazine. That was kind of the thing in the 80s. And so I would take Melaril and Thorazine and drink vodka. That was my, and straight vodka is what I loved. And I was, you know, kind of very slow at times. But twice, my heart stopped. I had full cardiac arrest. And one of the times was pure alcohol. I just drank too much, and I was on the street in Santa Barbara, and woke up at Cottage Hospital, and my chest hurt because, you know, someone on the street was like pounding on my chest, trying to get my heart started, and so I wasn't well, and so I had a little entree into sobriety where. I went to a couple meetings. I kind of went into the care unit up there for a little while, and I didn't get it. I didn't get what was going on, and I met a boy, and we were out of there, you know, just go. But about that time too. But I tried to get sober for a little while because I had met this woman who ultimately became my first sponsor, and it was a woman named Jan, and to me, she was everything in the whole wide world, and she had 2.5 years of sobriety, which to me was like mind-boggling, you know? Like, the people was super long-term. I didn't even believe them. I'm like, they're getting high or doing something, because you don't have 40 years or whatever that is. And when I was young, I thought, that's too long to be sober. It's too long of a time. And so, but she had 2.5 years, and so kind of tried to get sober, but in the midst of that, I started seeing a doctor up in Santa Barbara, and at first, he talked to me about being sober, you know, and about alcoholism, being sober, and I should be sober, and it's like, okay, and he was a medical doctor, but then he also did these, like, other, like, counseling something. So I was seeing him, and at first I was seeing him, you know, once a week, and then as time went on, he wanted to see me twice a week, and then he wanted to see me 3 times a week, and then in one of our sessions, I had said to him, you know, I think I like older men, and he said, well, I'm an older man, right during, then he was my therapist, you know, and when I first got sober, too, I thought I had never, you know, maybe prostituted myself or anything. But I remember looking at this man, you know, and he wasn't attractive. And, you know, he had this lab coat on and he, you know. And so bizarre when I think back on it. But I remember looking at him and thinking a couple things. Is that, one, he had a prescription pad that I could have anything that I wanted. And then he promised me, he lived in Montecito, and he said I could have a horse. So he said I could get high, I could get loaded, I could drink how I wanted, he would take care of me, and then, and so that happened. Now, to make a long story short, this man ended up doing that with many of his patients. So I was not his only one, but I always thought, I'm sure I was his favorite after all of, with all of these people, but... and he ultimately had his medical license removed, and it was like, so when I first got sober, too, literally hard copy was calling. So they did a full investigation and about the patients, about these people. I was one of the first people that kind of, I spoke out a little bit, and when I first got sober, my sponsor and a man I was seeing and others had to have their depositions taken as part of that lawsuit and investigation into him. So life wasn't good, and then during that time, too, I started, what I would do is I would make up pain, because I knew if I went to the doctor, you know, I'd also get pain medication, so I would make up pain and go to the doctor, and there was this one time where I had just been up for many days, and so I went to a different doctor, and I said that I was in pain, and nothing's wrong with me, and they did some tests, and the guy said, you have acute appendicitis. Like, we need to take your appendix out. And there was nothing wrong with me. And so I remember looking at this man, and I consciously thought, because I thought, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm just tired. I have been up for... And then I thought, in a few hours, I could be in surgery. I could be out, like, full anesthetic out. And I said, okay, like, let's go. And... So I have had my appendix out. I have had other surgeries. A number of things, you know, just put me out in the surgery. And so luckily, you know, I'm glad the first time I got sober, I was very young, because I would have, removed my kidney, whatever you want to do, just let me keep drinking. So at one point, you know, I knew I was going to die, but I didn't care. And I, too, maybe it was Paul, I think, had mentioned, you know, just not caring about living. And I didn't either. You know, a lot of times, and then sometimes in sobriety, too, I would cheer myself up when I would wake up by thinking, one day closer to death, you know, and that would just kind of cheer me up, you know. But I just saw, so the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I remember going to was a big Friday night meeting in Santa Barbara, and my sponsor took me there. It was the first time I just went to an AA meeting. And I remember hearing, my first meeting, I didn't even understand what's going on. When they was like, you know, I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic, and the whole room was like, hi, Bob. I was like, ah, wow. But I felt something. Like, I literally felt something special, and I felt the love of everybody. I thought, there's something very, very special with these people. And But shortly after that, I went to a meeting at, at that Alana Club, and I think my sponsor was leading at the meeting because it's set for, and I only had a few days, a couple of days sober, and I was sitting at the front table, and a man named Johnny Harris spoke, and some of you probably know him or have heard him, and so I was 19, and Johnny spoke, and Johnny, for those of you who haven't heard his story, you know, he was, you know, ran with gangs in Long Beach, you know, when he was a kid, and ended up in San Quentin, and almost went to life in prison, and so I sat there, and here I was, a 19-year-old girl from San Ynez, and I listened to him speak, and he said, I know what makes the big hurt go away. He would talk about the big hurt, and when I heard him, it was the first time in my life I had really related to anybody. And I thought, I belong here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I understand every word that man is saying. And Susan and I were talking about this. And I know that there's times in our lives where something happens, right? There's a moment. Some of us, it's a moment of clarity or something we hear. Life is like split in two, to like the time before that moment and the time after that moment. And that moment, hearing him, my life was never to be the same again. And I got sober, and to this day, he's like a father to me. Like we're very close, and so I got sober, and I would hear these incredible people, and I was just always taught, you know, you show up no matter what, and you get commitments, and you do the steps, and back then, I had a sponsee a couple years ago, because I don't even allow it anymore, but anyway, this one sponsee said to me, you know, you really hurt my feelings when you said that, and I thought, I've never said that to my sponsor in my life, you know, I can't imagine telling my sponsor, you really hurt my feelings when you, it's just like, when I got sober, we just had such respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it was, I knew I had been given a gift. I didn't think I was owed anything, which is a little bit of the difference, I think, what I see now, like where I get sober, where I live now in Orange County in California, and a lot of kids, and I did too. I was in treatment at one point, but a lot of people come out of the treatment center, and in the treatment center, they get to sit back. Like, you know, go ahead, fix me, you know? And in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, we're responsible. You know, we have to step up and take those actions. And so I just knew that. I just did that. And so life got really, really good. Life was good. But I ended up moving. I'd met a man and ended up moving. Always was active in AA, you know, to a certain extent. In my life, too, you know, my sponsor, too, it was, you know, what would you, now we got to do something, you know. And I remember asking this man, or in the words I used to say to him, I said, you know, why was I saved? It was my first few years. And he said, I had the same question. He said, I asked my sponsor that, and my sponsor said, maybe you were saved so you'd live your life as though you were worth saving. And that always stuck with me. And so I thought, well, yeah, I should do something, you know. And so I went and got my bachelor's degree, and then I went to law school. And externally, life got really good, and internally too, but I was really busy and working at a big firm. But what really happened? So it's 16 years I drink again. And one of the reasons I really talk about that and really honestly share my story is that starting around 14, 15 years sober, and I was in AA and active, but I started to get secrets. And I started to hold things within that I wasn't going to share with anybody. And I really got that thing about constant work with others. But I was sponsoring a ton of people, too many, and not talking to my own sponsor, and not talking to my best friends about, wow, I'm really tired, and I think I'm doing too much, or I'm, you know, whatever it was, there was things going on, and And I had one life in sobriety with someone, and I had met someone else that drank fine wine and was very handsome. And I thought, and I had a whole group of friends that went to France. You know, they'd go to France, and they'd go to Napa. And I never even went to Napa. Who wants to go? I grew up in wine country, you know. But I started to think, you know, I want to do that. And maybe I was young, one, and maybe long-term sobriety fixed it. Maybe it was 16 years. I know stuff now, you know. I know about alcoholism. So I never talked to anybody that I'm sober with, but I talked to my normie friends. And I said, I'm thinking about drinking. And they said, I think you can. And I'm like, you're absolutely right. So there was this day, and it was one of the more important drinks, because I got alcoholism. I knew it, you know, I knew it intellectually, and I knew powerlessness, but I didn't really know really what powerlessness is. And in the doctor's opinion, you know, and with alcoholism, it's physical and it's mental. And so that mental part has to be treated for a lifetime, you know, that we get the physical part, but that mental part, it's a daily reprieve from alcoholism. And that daily reprieve is very, very consistent with what we need to do. So that there was, and it's like in the big book, you know, I hadn't planned it on that day, but someone in my law firm had been sworn in to be an attorney, and so my whole staff, everybody, my law partner, everybody, we were down at a restaurant in Laguna Beach, and here's the thing we don't do too, is I had ordered like a virgin margarita or something, you know, we don't play with it, but I did, and my office administrator had a margarita, and she said, this drink's really strong. And I go, is it? And she goes, yeah. And she said, do you want to switch with me? And I go, yeah, I do. So we switched. And I took that sip of alcohol. And at first, my heart started pounding because I thought, oh, my God, I have like, you know. And then I took that second sip, and again, it hit my system, and I was like, why haven't I not been drinking for 16 years? It was like that fast, off and going. And then my law partner came over at one point, because he knew I was sober in AA. He would come to meetings and stuff to support me in my sobriety. And he came over, and he said, do you know what that is? And I go, yeah. I go, we drink in AA. And which was something, because he ended up coming into AA a couple years later, and then he would share, like, I came to AA because Lisa said we could drink here. And that's not what happens. But the miracle of it is that could have been, I could have died, because I was off and running. Immediately, I went home with a bottle of vodka. That weekend, or a couple weeks later, I was going out to the powwow. There's something called the powwow out in Palm Desert, California. Johnny and I, so a bunch of us played golf. Johnny and I, we were always on a team of golf. So it was Johnny Harris, me, and two other people playing golf. And so now I had been drinking, and I'm trying to be, if you want to be around Johnny Harris after you've been drinking, even the man in my life who had like 25 years sober, so everybody's long-term sobriety in my life. So I'm playing golf with Johnny, we get out of the cart, and I'd hit my shot, and then Johnny hit his shot. And he said to me, he looked me right in the eyes, and he said, you know, Lisa, I love you as my own daughter. And he goes, I have big shoulders, and there's nothing you can't say to me that we can't find a solution to. And he walked up the fairway. And I knew in that moment of, I'm not sober. And finished the round of golf, and then I left. I left the powwow. And I went back to Orange County. And, you know, you hear, and thank God it was just what I needed. You hear these very tough people in sobriety, right? Like, when you hit a bottom, come call us, you know. Wow, they didn't do that. I went back to Orange County and my phone blew up. You know, like, what is going on? And all I could say to everybody was, there's some sobriety issues. That's all I could say. So they came. They all came. They got me. Really, like, sat with me to get sober. And there was no judgment. In fact, a lot of times they would say to people, like, don't talk to her. You know, just don't. Just let her be, you know. And it absolutely saved my life. Now, here's the difference, is that before I was sober, and I think because I was younger too, the stories I loved were the ones, and again, this was the 80s, and I'd hear these stories, and in these guys, men and women, you know, the guy would be like, I was a straight, you know, a Skid Row drunk, and you know, at that time it was IBM, but say it's Google, and he's like, yeah, I was living on the streets, and now I'm CEO of Google, you know, and I'm like, wow, like, I loved those stories when I was young, you know, but after that moment, I knew that there was something so greater than anything that was going on in my life, and that the most beautiful gift anybody could be given is sobriety, let alone Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like, you know, we have that first surrender to alcoholism, and then that second surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous. That, you know, to me, it's Alcoholics Anonymous that works, and it works like nothing else. And you know, and Carl Jung, you know, the thing too about the spirits of alcohol, you know, the Latin word of, you know, it's the spirits. And so that spirits of alcohol is where there's a spirit that has to come from somewhere else. And I recently I had heard there was this sponsee had talked to me about one of her, a therapist or something, that was really talking down about AA and say, yeah, AA, you know, it's very self-deprecating when you say you're alcoholic and you know, that you're powerless, because it's like you're saying you're a victim, right? And I was saying, my only frustration is I wish people wouldn't comment on Alcoholics Anonymous when they've never been here or done it or even understood it, first of all, you know, because it literally kills people. And so I had to say to my sponsee too, it's like, oh, you know, like, no, we admit powerlessness. And then a power comes from somewhere, obviously. Like, that's what we do in the steps. And the steps go together. And, you know, not only do we admit powerlessness, but really by step 12, we can have conscious contact with God, you know, which is what I also love when people are like, hey, it's not enough for me. And I'm like, conscious contact with God is, or, you know. It's kind of, you know, it's miraculous what we experience in here. And so my life now, and it's really beautiful, you know, and I stood up here with 14 years sober, and, you know, I didn't stand up with 36 years sober, you know, and many of my friends are turning 40 and 35, you know, and so for any of you too, there are so many people, they come in here and they never drink again. And it's absolutely the thing that really should be, right? And then the reason I think that, you know, for some of us, there's all kinds of stories of people. And so if you're someone that came in here and you know, maybe you have relapsed, or you maybe, there has to be a time of forgiveness for that. And I never have thought, you know, because I would hear a lot too, it's like you relapse and then your ego is going to keep you out. You know, your ego is going to keep you out. And it's like, no. But I was thinking sometimes, and I talked to Johnny about this, it's like sometimes it's not our egos that keep us out. It's the spiritual arrogance of those who remain. You know, that sometimes you hear these things and it's like, wow, that's really, you know, painful, or, you know, whatever that is. And what I was just so loved to come back. And so I just want to say, and I share in my meeting too, there's someone that says, you know, you'd stick with the winners for sure. Stick with the winners of who's doing the deal, you know. But I always say, if you feel like a loser, you can sit next to me. You know, it's like there's a seat for you, you know. And so there's... And then the other part of that too is that, you know, to share your story, you know, whatever your story is. And there's this great book called The Spirituality of Imperfection, which is a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous and stories, you know, and that from religion and from Alcoholics Anonymous, and that, you know, our great gift from God is our stories, our life stories. Like, this happened to me, and this is what I'm doing, and this is who we are, and great truths and wisdom come through that. And I really didn't want to tell my story again for a long time. And about a year ago, and I thought this was so humbling that there was a meeting up in Washington, and they were having their big 50-year anniversary, and they asked me to come up and speak. And in that meeting, the speakers only have 20 plus years of sobriety. And so I had said, you know, I don't have 20 years anymore. You know, I don't have 20. And they said, no, we heard your story. And there's people in the room that's had long-term sobriety and they're struggling. And we want you to come up and share your story. And I thought, wow, that's, how great is that? You know, and so if you're someone that doesn't want to share your story or it's not the great, perfect, you know, thing, you know, please share it. You know, let us know who you are and let us learn from that experience. And now I don't keep any secrets, whatever it is. I don't have a secret. And whatever I can't share with my sponsor, I share with my best friends. You know, it's, you know, I have a sponsor, his name's Ray Jeffers, and he lives in Palm Desert. And sometimes I don't want to tell him things, or I want to run it through people first, and then I'll tell him, you know. I don't keep secrets, and for many years before that, I had a sponsor named Sharon Barker, and Clancy was my grand sponsor, and with them too, you know, it was like, yeah, I don't know, there's just certain things I don't want to do. I was just very like, kind of honest about it, and they said, let's, you know, for me to have my own comfort and my own sobriety, and so I do that today. And there has been incredible healing in my family, where my dad, my mom died recently, and my dad died a few years ago. And on my dad's deathbed, it was interesting too, because he got sick and he died quickly. So he got sick, and then he died about 3.5 weeks later. And on his deathbed, it was interesting if you've been with someone getting ready to pass away, and he was like reviewing his life, and it wasn't these accomplishments. He was saying, "Remember when we took that bike ride?" And I said, "Yeah." And at one point, my whole family was around him, and only my brother knew I had relapsed. And at that point, you know, so I was getting birthday cards, you know, because they thought, you know, that they didn't realize I had relapsed at some point. And I talked to my sponsor, and she had said, let's just not tell them, because they were older, and why worry them, and, you know, that type of thing. So everyone's on the deathbed around my dad, and my dad said, he said, I haven't had an alcoholic beverage for 19 years. Like, you could tell it was the most important thing in his life. And he said, honey, how long has it been for you now? And, you know, there's that moment. And so at the time, I don't even remember, I mean, you know, it wasn't that long ago, but it's like 10 years, you know, 8, 9, 10 years. And so I said to him, well, Dad, I have, you know, 8, 9 years, and I said, you know, I had a little bump in the road, and he just got this big smile on his face, and he said, oh, and he's like, you're gonna get there again. It's like he just, and it was the most important thing, and that morning he passed away, and I love them so much, you know, that family with fighting and trauma, and that year prior, and we had all made amends, you know, and I was, maybe because I'm the youngest too, like I'm the hugger, you know, for years I would tell my mom, I'd go, I love you, and my mom would go, thank you, honey, you know, that was her life, I'm like, thank you, you know, and it was so weird, and then towards the end of her life, with big hugs, like, I love you, and really, that came because of Alcoholics Anonymous, like, and in California, we're just huggers. Like, we hug, and, you know, and so, you know, my dad and I had, you know, shared how much I love him, and such healing in our lives. But he, the year before he died, they were going to move from Palm Desert up here to Washington, because they always loved Washington, but they were staying close to Orange County. So I asked my dad, and you know, and by this point I'm like 40 something years old, but I said to him, I go, so why haven't you moved? Why haven't you guys moved up to Washington? And he started to cry, he said, I just don't want you to ever think that we left you. And that wasn't about that moment. That was about years before that. And so I just talked to him. I said, I love you. You never left me. And I would never be who I am without you, you know. And so even the story I have, you know, it's interesting in time how our stories, you know, even my stories about my parents would be, you know, different than, you know, now I think, thank God I had them. In every aspect of my life, I'm who I am because of Alcoholics Anonymous in them. And so tremendous, tremendous healing. And you know, in this last coming up on 15 years now, I also, when I was young, I always wanted to go to seminary. I really didn't want to go to law school. I wanted to go to seminary. And but being a good alcoholic, I don't fit anywhere. You know, it's like I'm religious, but I'm like there's just a little bit that I don't get. You know, but anyway, I went to seminary and got a doctorate in ministry. And in fact, I was going to minister a church up in Washington, and there were just certain things I just want to go, I don't know. And I guess if you're the minister of the churches, you should know, you know. And I'm like, I just don't know exactly if I. So the one thing I knew, just like we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, live our lives as though they were worth saving. And one thing I don't do is, and the message I never heard either was that sometimes, for some reason, because we're alcoholics, we're very sick and broken and damaged. And the book talks about transformation. The book talks about restored to sanity. The book talks about these, you know, amazing, amazing things. And that something so much higher runs through that. Like, I really think too, if I just stayed with, I'm just a sick, broken alcoholic, that I wouldn't be fulfilling, you know, the purpose of, you know, of God. And I remember, you know, I had these things happen too, like early on in sobriety. I was in my office in Laguna Beach, and I had all the windows open, and I think I had like a couple of weeks sober. This was when I was coming back, and this bird flew into my office, and I couldn't get the bird out of the office. It's like 10 o'clock in the morning, and it was just driving me crazy. So I tried to get the bird out, couldn't get the bird out. And on the way to work that morning, I had seen this woman walking in Laguna, and she's kind of dressed really nice. She didn't look like she was from Laguna, but I noticed her. I thought, I wonder what she's doing, you know. And so I go into my office and couldn't get the bird out. And so I just thought, I'm just going to get coffee. So I left the doors open, all the windows open. I'm like, I'm going to get a cup of coffee, come back. So I'm walking down the street, and I see her. And I just went up to her for, you know, some reason. And I said, are you looking for something? And she said, yeah, I'm looking for a place called the Canyon Club. And it's the Canyon Club Laguna, where we have a lot of AA meetings. It was an AA clubhouse. And I said, oh, I go, yeah, well, I know it. I go, you're a couple miles from here, but I can drive you there. So I said, you know, come up to my, so I got my keys. And so I started to drive her to the meeting. And she said, yeah. She goes, I'm from out of town, and I'm here with my husband. He's in a business meeting. And I've been walking back and forth on that street trying to decide if I'm going to take a drink. And she said, I have 16 years sober, and I want to take a drink. So I got her in my car, and I took her to the meeting, and I told her my story. And I said, you know, however, I was new. And to this day, she sends me cards, and she stayed sober. And I took her to the meeting, and that's what our sobriety is about. You know, that's what our lives are about. It's these precious moments of time where we save each other and we're there for each other. And I'm so profoundly grateful. You know, I am grateful for each and every one of you and my sobriety, and that you're here, and that you show up and so gracious, and, you know, ask somebody you don't even know to, you know, come talk here. And but that you've taken your seat, and I want to thank you for that. And right before he passed, Dr. Bob spoke at it was three months before he passed, and he spoke at a convention, and he was really sick and had been in bed, and he spoke briefly, and just said, paraphrasing, but may we keep Alcoholics Anonymous the simplicity of what it is. You know, that not great, grand, metaphysical, you know, things, but the simplicity and the beauty of what it is. And those principles and the beauty and the one alcoholic talking to another and the love and the compassion and the forgiveness and like all of those things we live, that's the simplicity and then so profound when we live it on a daily basis. To me, that's the higher power and the thread that runs through this all, whether you call that God or whatever that may be for you. And so I just want to thank you, and that's it.